where should I go? What should I do? I don't know what is the way to where I'm going to. Is this twilight before the daybreak? Or is this whole fight just a pause for the forces that I battle, attacked by the black of night? Black of night, black of night, black of night. Metal horses broken down, broken legs, it makes no sound. A child getting deep inside is freezing from nowhere to hide. I brought my dreams into this place, not expecting winter to erase.
All right, I gotta wrap these up. I'm it's actually now it's not. It's 1:42 in the morning. It was May Day, and that inspired me to make these podcasts today. I've got these 8 Shaolin Records podcasts, and I was hoping to kind of do it weekly. And when I was in my car, it was a little easier. But now I've got a bigger production going in. For the first time, I'm making them in video. And so I'm just figuring it out. And I came to realize when I'm the hippie coyote, I'm going to wear my coyote hat. This is what I was wearing before I got married back in 1989. This is where I used to perform in as the coyote back in the 80s. And so this is my coyote hat. And then during the 90s, I got when I was the Kung Fu master, I got a dark brown cowboy hat. And then when I was the Kung Fu cowboy, I got a black cowboy hat. I actually had a beige hat also for a while. That was given to me, a special gift that I wore for about, I don't know, half a dozen years at least, maybe more than that, before I got the black cowboy hat. So you see a few pictures of me as the Kung Fu cowboy performing with that kind of a light beige hat. Really, that was nice. Very, very nice hat. I wore that thing out. I like most of my hats. This one's made of leather, so this one's very rugged. This one's pretty hard to completely wear out. It's pretty beat up. But anyway, hippie coyote here. And I decided I'm doing these 8 podcasts with Shaolin Records. I get to be the hippie coyote twice. So I was the hippie coyote a while ago and the Coyote Radio TV show. And I came for this one, the History of American Zen. And I realized, well, for American Zen, maybe I'll just wear whatever I want. I'll wear a different shirt every time. Whereas the other ones, I'll be more consistent. And I'll change the background for each show, too. So I'm trying to make it a little more unique. But when I'm the hippie coyote, I'll wear this hat. So you'll kind of recognize me. And I got all these shirts. I've collected all these shirts. I've thrown away so many. But when I moved in here, I kind of realized, well, maybe I can make use of all these shirts. Even if I'm not going to wear them in public, I could actually wear them for podcasts. Because there are all kinds of different shirts from different clubs I performed at and different places I was in the 80s and magazines I worked for. And so I was thinking maybe this would be the... I just finally realized I had this stack of t-shirts. And I thought maybe I could use those for, you know, I'm the coyote in a podcast. And this would probably be the one. So for every one of these History of American Zen shows, you know, I'll use one of these old... shirts. This one's from the DGA, Directors Guild. And back in the 80s, when I was the coyote and I was doing the coyote graveyard, at the end of it, at the end of the coyote coyote in a graveyard rock opera, when I was performing that in Los Angeles, I was attending UCLA Film School. And when I was in UCLA Film School, I was working for the DGA also. They were renting me out to the DGA. So they were hiring me at a really low rate, and then they were making a profit by renting me to the DGA. And then the DGA, of course, was saving money because if they had to hire anybody through the DGA, they'd pay a lot more. And so I was in charge of their Blu-ray library. They were building their video library. And so for about a year, somebody else probably got the job after I left, you know, because then I stopped working for them, you know, for them. But it was really cool when I was. And my job was to watch all these Blu-rays. They'd buy the Blu-rays, but they had to have somebody inspect them. They couldn't just put them in their vault and presume they were okay. So someone had to actually watch every one of these Blu-rays all the way through. That was me. So I was paid to watch movies for a year. That was kind of cool. That was a great job. I love that job. I got paid to watch movies. And so I've got a bunch of stories about that and working with the DGA a little bit. And everybody got to know me. I practically had a key. I could go in and out of the DGA and walk around. Because I was there every week, you know, delivering these Blu-rays. So that was kind of nice for a while. But at that time, I still didn't think I was going to be was I really going to be a director? I still thought I was going to be a writer and a performer and write the soundtracks. And yeah, I guess I did, because when I graduated UCL, by the time I graduated there, I was taking the master directing classes, and production classes. So I realized I was going to be a producer and a director. And look who's here. Hi, buddy. Just jumped on my lap. Hi there, Bear. So I'll wear different shirts. But yeah, for the history of American Zen, I just had a couple of notes here. And I don't know what I'm going to do. Let's start with the Level 1 album. I got all kinds of stories about that. But the drums on that, I was living in Utah. And the drums on that are recorded on an Oberheim DX. You can't see it. It's right back there on the other side of the screen. I should have maybe thought of pulling it out for you. But it was made in the early 80s, one of the first really wonderful drum machines made. In fact, it's what the Van Halen were using. The first synthesizers they were using were this DX, and they were using it for the I don't know if they were using the drum machine, but the DX synthesizer. But the whole thing was a really great synthesizer. This is only the drum machine, and they're digital recordings of real drums, you know, and then you can tune them and do different things to them. And so that's what I do used for the first Level 1 album. You could only program short things. I had a very small memory in it too. So you really had to perform, and I didn't really loop it. Well, I did loop it a little bit, you know, but I really tried to perform it. And the way you do it is you can quantize, so it'll make everything sound even. And I didn't want that, because I was always been anti-drum machine. So I quantized it to the 64th note. So you'll actually hear maybe once in a while, there's a drum mistake. I can hear them. There's like maybe only two on the album that actually bother me, where I'm hitting the drum. I go, oh man, that's just a little late. But I made it to the 64th so I could get that feeling. And that's why a lot of people think it's a real drummer, or they say, man, you're really good at the drum machine. Well, it's not that I'm really good at it. It's just that I played it, number one. And number two, I didn't quantize it. I made it so that, you know, I could make mistakes on it and I'd have to re-record it. Oh, that was just a little off. I had to re-record it, and I made it so that I had to really play it really well, and I beat those little pads, you know. I played it. I really played the drums, you know. You know, I didn't just and then quantize it so it sound really even. No, I tried to make it so that it would slow down and have swing. And you can add swing effects to it, but I never even figured that out. Never even tried it. Never even tried to do that. It can make things retard a little bit to get more of a feel, but I never played with that. I just figured I want to play the feel. So I'm really playing that drum machine, that DX. So on the Level 1 album, when you hear the drums, they sound kind of natural. And like I said, there's even a couple of mistakes in a couple spots, and that's because I didn't go back and fix it, you know, punching that one that'll fix. And I would always max it out. If I looped anything, I would use it as minimal as possible. I would just totally max out my memory until I couldn't use any more memory. And then I would kind of have to loop things, you know, to really play the whole song, because it didn't have a memory card big enough to really play the whole song. It couldn't remember that much, you know, it wasn't designed for that. So it's really a primitive, you know, old drum machine. So anyway, that's why the Level 1 has a real natural drum feel to it, is because, like I said, I'm really playing them, and I quantize to the 64th note. You know, I don't know if you've ever heard I've never heard anybody else do that. And they always say, oh, quantize to the 16th. No, I didn't even want to quantize to the 32nd. I quantized to the 64th. Now, I made it so I had the maximum ability to be sloppy. So that's how the Level drum one's recorded. And I say that I'm Steve Hixon. And Steve Hixon passed away back in the 80s, I think, or something. I had heard he'd passed away. I found out about it after the fact, because he wasn't living in San Diego, and I was gone. So I don't know what really happened to him. You know, his wife was Anna. I don't even know if he had any kids. Far as I know, he didn't. But I don't know the story of him. But Steve Hixon was the first drummer I ever played with. And actually might not have been the first, but he was the first one I really ever remembered and had fun with. Yeah. There was a couple other drummers. I had one drummer that I performed with, and another drummer who was my friend who got me into the drug dealing business because his older brother was running kilos back and forth across the Mexican border every day. And I could tell you all about that. I became part of that operation. Not really, but I mean, I was there hanging out. I was about 13, 14 years old. And these guys were all 18 or 19 years old. And they were going back and forth across the border every day in a white El Camino. I tell you that much. And so that made it seem more inconspicuous, you know, to be driving an El Camino across and bringing all these kilos across. And so that was the operation back there. And I got to see it, and I was part of that. And so as a result, they said, well, so I got all free pot. I wanted to add lots of pot. But then I realized I could make some money. So I had a paper route, and I was able to buy my guitar. And then when I was done buying my guitar, I didn't want to have the paper route anymore because I had to get up early in the morning and stuff. And, you know, I'm a rock and roller. I only did it to get my guitar. So then I gave up the paper route. But I had some money left over, so decided I wanted to invest it. So I invested in the drug business. And so I would buy a kilo, and then I would break it up into what we called lids or cans, which were like about an ounce, just rough them out. You just take this whole kilo, which is 2.2 pounds. I never weighed anything. And then you just break it up into baggies until you got so many baggies, you know, and different people would make them thicker or smaller, depending on how much profit you wanted. I was always generous. You measure them by the fingers. I was always doing 4-finger lids, you know, maybe 3 fingers if it was Acapulco gold and it cost a lot more. And I'd charge another $5 and make it a little smaller because I'd have to pay more for it anyway. And anyway, I'd have all this pot and then I'd roll up shoe boxes full of joints and go to parties, and I was everybody's friend because I just pass out joints everywhere. So anytime I showed up, man, everybody's, hey, there's Connor. So yeah, I was a psychedelic hero back in those days, and just passing out joints all the time. And I'd roll 4 paper joints, 12 paper, well, 12 papers were really hard, big cigars. Those things would fall apart. And, yeah, and there's a lot of, anyway, and you have to take all the seeds out of them. Whenever we got this pot, it almost always had seeds in it because it weighed more and they were going to the maximum yield when they harvested them. So that was when there were seeds. And so they would wait till that last minute before they harvest. So, you know, there was always seeds you had to take out. Those things would be firing off like popcorn. Yeah. I lift those in the joints. So there was a whole art to getting the seeds out, which I could talk about. In fact, maybe I'll remember to show you. I have one of the things that I used to use, which was when I was a little kid, we had a little Pepsi tray, Pepsi-Cola tray that, you know, you'd put on a counter and serve drinks and take it back to the kitchen, put drinks on it and serve it. And I got this old thing. It's a collector's item probably. Might even be worth a lot of money. But that's what I used to use as for seeds because I used shoebox lids, which were really good because they're being a little rough. You know, they would hold the pot, but the seeds would roll down. And so you could kind of, using something like a matchbook cover, which would be like a business card, but we didn't have business cards or kids. So using matchbook covers, you just keep, you know, raking it up to the top and the seeds would roll down to the bottom and you do that and that's how you'd get the seeds out. And so anyway, yeah, the psychedelic 60s, those are wonderful times. I was having a good time. So anyway, Bill Holder, no, you may have the wrong name, but I don't want to give somebody in trouble. We call him Thick. His name was Thick because he was always a little heavy. He wasn't fat, but he was always a little thick. Wasn't that smart either, but I never thought of him as thick in the head, even though maybe he was. He was a good friend. He was my best friend, to be honest with you. And so I used to hang out with him all the time. In fact, he was the first person I ever smoked pot with. And boy, did I get high, because remember, he was getting the best stuff. And it might have been Acapulco Gold, because I remember it was kind of brownish. And I think it was more like tobacco. Man, we smoked that, and I was in La La Land. And I could tell you some more stories about that. But yeah, we get quite high. That was a lot of fun. And so anyway, psychedelic 60s, got tales about that. But anyway, the drum machine I made after Steve Hickson, how to get off. I was talking about all the different drummers I worked with back then in the early 60s. But Steve Hickson was my neighbor. He was a few houses away. And he had a really nice loud stereo. So I could play along to the stereo. And my best memory is, I mean, we'd play to Tommy, The Who, but it was really Blue Cheer. The first album by Blue Cheer, man, I just loved playing along to that, playing the guitars. Second time around, da 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 da, you know, just blasting away and playing along. And he'd wear headphones. In fact, what he'd often do is he would wear headphones, so I wouldn't even hear the music, you know. And he'd be listening to the music, or I could barely hear it, and he could hear it, so he could hear the drums better and play along more. So he wasn't that good of a drummer. So he was usually playing along to the album, and then I was jamming along, playing along, like I was part of the band, and then I could kind of jam and go off in little other directions. But yeah, I remember him playing headphones, and I think I could still hear the band, because I remember I was playing along with the band a lot too. So, but yeah, he'd play so loud, I think he couldn't hear the music, you know, so he wore headphones and play through the speakers, and I'd play along jamming away. So we had a good time, and so anyway, I just got all kinds of memories, plus we used to drop acid together a lot of the time. So Steve Hickson and I dropped acid lots and lots of times. I got good stories about that. And that's one of the things about it. See, that the good part about LSD is if you can handle it, it actually can broaden your mind. Now, as I learned and I watched a lot of people take it and freak out, if you have mental problems, LSD is only going to magnify them. You know, it's just going to magnify your mental problems. So the people who had mental problems, they were gone. That was not good for them. That was not good. But if you didn't have mental problems, you know, you could use it as a recreational tool, and it was kind of fun. And so I had certain friends that I would, every weekend, you know, sometimes I'd drop acid during the week, but, you know, couldn't get away with it as well. I got stories about that too, dropping during the week and getting almost in trouble. But it was really the weekends, because these trips took, you know, several hours. You know, you'd pop it at like 7, you'd come on like 45 minutes to an hour, and then you'd peak like 45 minutes to an hour later, and then it would go down for about an hour, and then you had an hour to recover, and, you know, and then it was nothing. But, you know, you couldn't go home. We were kids. So, you know, 10 o'clock was too early to go home. You dropped acid. That was just too early. So you'd have to spend the night out. I'd say I'm spending the night at Bob Morris's house, and Bob Morris would say, spending the night at my house. And then we'd go drop, and then we'd sleep in the, you know, we'd jump over the fence and sleep in the schools, you know, between the buildings, and take sleeping bags. Sometimes right there in the canyons, right by our houses, you know, we just go down and we'd hide our sleeping bags in the canyons. We did that a lot. We just hide our sleeping bags out, because if I was going to his house, I'd take my sleeping bag to sleep on his floor. And then he'd take his sleeping bag to supposedly sleep on my bedroom floor. But we'd take our sleeping bags, and we'd go meet in the canyon and hide them under some sagebrush, and then we'd go drop it, and then we'd come back sometime around midnight. Well, actually, at 10 o'clock, the police would be looking for you, because remember, it was us against the police back then. They were the heat. They were the man. It was a war against young people against old back then. And so at 10 o'clock curfews, that was their chance to really nail people and arrest them for drugs and bust them and get, you know, they were out there just cause us trouble. They weren't there to help us. They didn't want to help us. They just want to bust us. And so after 10 o'clock at night, you have to hide. You have to find ways to hide. And even during that 10 to 10:30, you know, you'd see car lights coming and you'd jump over into the bushes. Even if I was on my way home, I'd jump over into the bushes so I wouldn't get arrested and have the police take me home or, you know, get hassled. So after 10 o'clock, you just really had to hide, because the police were then just looking for you. They were just like sharks, just cruising the streets looking. So anytime I saw car headlights, I'd jump into the bushes, wait till they pass, and then I'd head back home still, even if I was late. If I was supposed to be home at 10, if I didn't get home by 10:30, I was hiding from every headlight that I saw on my way home. So I remember doing that quite a bit. hiding in the bushes while the headlights passed, because you didn't know what kind of car it was. And sometimes it was the heat, and most time it wasn't, but just too scared, you know. But anyway, that was because we're little kids. So anyway, yeah, so that's why I say we sleep in the canyons, have to hide, and sometimes we'd have to run. I remember getting chased, literally chased, and our biggest defense was, of course, when we get to a school fence, we could climb over the school fence, and the police couldn't, you know, they're, you know, big donut bellies. That was just a little bit too much rambunctiousness for them, yeah, so they were, if we could climb over the school fence, then we were good, we could get away. As long as they couldn't cut us off somewhere else or something. So usually a lot of the school fences would have a canyon nearby. So you'd climb over that fence, run to the other end of the school, and then you could climb over that fence and go into a little canyon and hide. And I did that many, many times. I never got caught, ever, ever. But I did run quite a few times. In fact, one time I told this story one time somewhere, some podcast. But there was this one policeman who had been chasing me. And I'm talking kind of softly because it's really late at night and I'm afraid they're going to hear me next door. this policeman was chasing me. He called me a rabbit because I was so fast and I could dodge around. He couldn't catch me. And then finally I got to a fence, climbed over and got away. But he recognized me. He was able to see who I was. And I was in a grocery store and he snuck up on me and grabbed me, you know, scared the crap out of me. I'm in a grocery store and he grabs me. I got you, you little rabbit. And he was like really just mean and vicious to me. I don't know what you're talking about. That was you. You were in that with the park. Just played dumb. Just didn't admit it. And shaking me and being all mean to me and everything. But he didn't hit me. But he was really, really being mean to me. He had to let me go because he couldn't prove it was me. But he was just mean and vengeful. I mean, that's how they looked at us. I mean, they just wanted to catch us. They didn't. He was not happy I got away, but he did. He recognized me. I recognized him too, but I didn't let him know. So anyway, but yeah, History of American Zen. I think I went back a little too far. We were supposed to be, American Zen started in 1992 when I was in Salt Lake City. So where was I? Oh, well, the drum machine and with Steve Hickson, and then Steve Hickson took me back. So that's how I got caught up in that little storyline. Oh, I think I'm actually supposed to read to you from Utah Phase One, but I forgot to get the book out. Well, I could go get it real quick. I forgot. What poem did I read you last time? I don't even remember. Well, yeah, I'll just read you something next time. So anyway, there you go. Well, I'll read you from Utah Phase One next time. So level one story, it was the DX drum machine. And so, yeah, I'm really proud of what I did on that album. And it's why it sounds really natural is because I really played them. I really played those drums. And I played them so that it was hard to play. I had to make lots of takes because I would make mistakes. You just hit it a hair late, you know, and it would jump into that next 64th note. And it would be just, oh, that's too late. That's or too early. You know, wasn't right. So I'd have to play those little pieces of each song, you know, like just a verse. I'd have to play that whole verse and get it just right, you know. And if I didn't do it, I'd have to re-record it and just do it over and over again. Then I'd record the chorus and get that just right. So it was a challenge. But so I didn't take the easy route. I wanted to go make it sound as good as I could. All right, Hippie Coyote out of here.
Says, well, he'll scorn as Moroni blows his golden horn. The Church of the Latter-day Saints. Give us your children so your soul is raised.
God will protect. God will protect. God will protect. Thank you.
Babylon and Zion. Brigham Young says wealth he'll scorn as Moroni blows his breath.